Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.byteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Peg O'Connor. She is author of Life on the Rocks, Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery. Addiction and recovery are, at their core, about the meaning of life. Life on the Rocks is the first book to address addiction and recovery from a Western philosophical perspective, offering a powerful set of tools sharpened over millennia. It introduces some of the core concepts and vexing questions of philosophy to help addicts and those affected by their addiction examine and perhaps transform the meaning they make out of their lives. Without assuming any familiarity with philosophy, Dr. O'Connor illuminates issues all addicts and their loved ones face: self-identity, moral responsibility, self-knowledge and self-deception, free will and determinism, fatalism, the nature of God, and their relations to others. Life on the Rocks is an indispensable guide to the deeply philosophical concerns at the heart of every addict struggle. Dr. O'Connor is a professor of philosophy in gender, women, and sexuality studies at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota. She is author of the popular Psychology Today blog, Philosophy Stirred, Not Shaken, and contributor to the Pro Talk series at Rehabs.com. Peg's book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to her book there in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Peg to the show. Good day, Peg. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Robert. I think this is going to be a great conversation.
I am confident it will be. So this
I'd
is
like
great.
Confidence.
Well, you know, this is such an important topic, you know, that affects so many people. And any time that we can shed light on addiction and recovery and help people you know, choose better, make better in their lives, it's always a good thing. So,
Well, there certainly are a lot of us who need that help.
Well, you know, let's start with, first of all, why did you write Life on the Rocks? And also the title, it seems like the title has special meaning as well.
the title. We'll start with the title first, the easier question.
Right.
So, Life on the Rocks, Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery. So I'm an alcoholic and I like to drink. So the on the rocks was a reference to ice with drinks. But on the rocks could also be a rock of crack cocaine, a rock of crystal meth. And life on the rocks in terms of I spend a lot of time, I grew up on the East Coast and spent a lot of time near the ocean. And what happens when the tide comes in and you start getting thrown against the rocks, or, you know, boats get thrown against the rocks, and it can lead to a lot of destruction. So I just liked that title of Life on the Rocks, and that some of us, through a variety of means and methods, live on the rocks and have lived on the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And the rocks can also be a place to live and thrive if you pay any close attention to shoreline and to see what can still grow up through rocks and next to rocks. And I just like the imagery of it. And
that's how I chose
the title. And then the longer question answer, why did I write this book? So as I said, I am an alcoholic. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober for a good long time. And by training, I'm a professor of philosophy, studied a lot of moral philosophy. And I will always claim that philosophy helped me to get and stay sober. It gave me this incredible treasure trove of concepts and questions to ask myself, to interrogate myself. And one of the oldest understandings of philosophy is that it's an activity. It's a way of being in the world that perhaps was exemplified by the philosopher Socrates, who in 399 BCE had been found guilty of corrupting the fine young upstanding men of Athens, and he was in the trial phase, or the sentencing phase of his trial. And he said, the unexamined life is not worth living. And he had been given the opportunity to escape and to live in exile, and he said, I can't do that if I can't practice philosophy. So philosophy has always been about examining your life, what we might call your moral character, and what we might also describe as your relationship to yourself and to particular others and to your broader community or city-state. And I think that's a wonderful way to understand philosophy. It's an activity. It isn't reserved just for those of us who have studied philosophy in college or have gone on to study more of it. Addicts are some of the most philosophical people I have ever come upon. And I'm talking to people perhaps who have no background but can ask that question or offer that insight that really would make me stop to say, oh, my gosh, that is a philosophical question.
Yeah. You know, and I can see where addicts would be very philosophical because in so many cases it is that search for self, you know, and that you know, that meaning of life. And it's interesting, but, you know, I've never really thought of philosophy as like action, you know, I mean, as a way to live life. To me, it had always been concept, you know, rather than implementation. And so, I mean, you know, your book really kind of brings home the idea that we have these concepts, but then they do translate into actions in our everyday life.
Yeah, that they are action guiding and help us to make meaning. And, you know, Nietzsche is a philosopher who was writing in the late 1800s, and he was a tortured man in all kinds of ways and ended up having what we might now call a severe psychotic break and died while living in an asylum. But he was this wonderful student of human nature and the human condition, which is always the subject matter of philosophy. And he wrote in various places and in various ways that part of the human condition is suffering, and that we suffer doesn't make us unique. And when we can't make sense of our suffering, that's intolerable. But when we can transform and make sense of our suffering, that's actually when we survive and perhaps even thrive in a kind of way. And I understand addiction as a cause and consequence of suffering, and it always is going to come down to, well, how am I leading my life? What kind of meaning can I make? What kind of sense can I make of myself? And what kind of sense can I make to others? And that's all in what I do, not just in what I say.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, so in this book is certainly unique from basically all other books out there on addiction and recovery. And I've had quite a few guests over the 5 years. I've had quite a few guests and have, you know, had books, read books about addiction and recovery. And yours is truly unique, you know, in that.
Oh, well, gosh, thanks.
Well, it is. So would you explain to the listeners exactly how it is unique from those that are out there right now?
Oh, boy. Well, I think it's unique in two ways. One is the use of philosophy. I'm drawing on philosophers, starting with Socrates in 399 BCE, up until contemporary times. So I'm using about 2,500 years of good thoughts on all things human nature. So I've got a long list of people to draw from. It's unique because it's aimed towards the general reader, the general public, not for other academic philosophers. And it's unique in part because philosophy, I think, is the original source of self-help. I mean, I know we think about self-help a lot now. It's this whole genre when you go into Barnes & Noble. The self-help section is bigger than any other section, it seems to me, except perhaps romance novels, perhaps. And to think about what it means to help yourself in certain kind of ways, to lead a life that Aristotle is writing in about 350 BCE, so grand student of Socrates, Aristotle talks about flourishing. How is it that a person can not just survive in their life, because animals survive, but how can we flourish? And I love thinking about the notion of human flourishing, individual flourishing and flourishing of communities. And one of the ways that this book is unique is that it really necessarily ties together the well-being of individuals with the well-being of their communities. So when I think about addiction, addiction most certainly is something that an individual has or suffers from. But addictions also and oftentimes define the dynamic within a family. And addictions are both a public policy and a public health crisis for some communities. So to look at some communities that have been utterly just devastated by so much heroin, or I live in a rural area of Minnesota where there was a lot of crystal meth, and the effects that that has on communities. So the importance of bringing those two pieces of the puzzle into conversation with one another. And I think we're starting to see more of that as we talk about what can communities do to try to prevent, say, heroin. There's so much heroin out there now. And prevent prescription drug abuse, that it doesn't come down just on any one party, but it's got to be this really concerted effort from very different corners of communities coming together in a kind of way. And the only way a community can flourish is that if its individuals flourish, and individuals can't flourish if their communities as a whole are suffering. So that's, I think, one of the ways in which it's unique. And I think it's also unique in that it invites readers along to tap into some of those questions that they've had, and they've thought, maybe I am the only person who has ever thought about this. I hear that a lot, say, in AA meetings or other kinds of self-help groups, where people say, oh, my gosh, I'm the only one who ever thought like that. And wow. Say, you know what, philosophers have been looking at some of those questions for a very long time is a way to start making sense. Maybe I'm not just as strange or wacky as I thought I was, but if this has animated people 1,000 years ago, well, maybe then that means it's an important question, and I'm not stupid for having it.
Yeah, that's, you know, that is, I think, you know, that recognition that what one is going through is not only, you know, not unique, you know, in today's society, but the fact that it's gone on for centuries, you know, and then it's something that has been a struggle for people, some people, for eons, you know, knowing that, then it's kind of like, well, you know, you kind of, the person would feel, I would think, that it's like, when I'm not as unusual, you know, as I've kind of, you know, thought that I was, or you know, it's not, you know, the fact that it's gone on for such a long time just makes me feel a little bit better in the sense that it's, you know, I'm not a victim of, you know, current circumstances or, you know, the current environment or community or what, you know, whatever. But I mean, there's, it seems that it would be at least when it comes, I think there was one chapter in your book, you talk about the person wondering if they were a moral failure, feeling like a moral failure. So, I mean, it would seem like that would alleviate some of that feeling.
Oh, and that sense of feeling like a moral failure is just so pervasive of people who struggle with addiction. And even those who get in recovery, I think, are still vulnerable to it. And I know I'm vulnerable to it, perhaps because I think I need to be doing so much penance to make up for some of the bad things that I've done. As a Catholic, the notion of penance is a good mind. But yeah. that feeling that I'm a moral failure because, why? I didn't perhaps meet an impossible standard that no one else can meet it, and yet I expect myself to meet it. That a lot of the times when we feel like moral failures, and I think sometimes genuinely a person can morally fail. I think there are all kinds of examples of when a person genuinely fails to meet a moral obligation or a moral requirement. I'm not saying moral failings don't exist. What's always really interesting is when a person makes a shift from saying, oh, I made a mistake, I failed at something, to the more global identity of I am a failure. And that's a really significant kind of move. And I think I would identify, you know, that shift from I've made mistakes and I have failed to I am myself a failure. I think actually when you look at the gap between those two, I think for a lot of people, that's where you start to see their use, misuse, and abuse of substances or behaviors, where that really starts to accelerate.
Yeah, I agree. There is a, there's a big chasm between those two. The question I want to ask now, since we're talking about, morality, from a philosophical point of view, is it immoral to take drugs? Or, how does morality fit into it? I mean, because, morality, back in the ancients, what some of the things were being done today aren't necessarily considered immoral. You know what I mean? So how do we navigate, morality, addiction, and philosophy?
That's a great question that has yet so many different dimensions to it. Let me see if I can maybe hit a couple of them.
Great.
I think it's accurate to say that for a long time, discussions of morality and addiction got wrapped together in a certain kind of way along the following lines, that someone who was an addict was a moral reprobate or was morally lazy or was just had a weak character such that they could not resist the temptations that were understood to be addictive. And that ties back to one of the ways that we have traditionally understood addiction, is that it's a weakness of will. Some people just lack self-control or lack willpower. Now, we've started to undergo some important changes in jettisoning that conception of addiction, because it turns out not only is it not very helpful, it's descriptively, factually not accurate. So when now we think about morality and addiction, I'm hoping that we can broaden the discussions of responsibility. Here's how I see the question framed most times. Well, are addicts responsible for becoming addicts? Are they responsible because they've been making choices? And it becomes important to say, not all choices are created the same. You know, my choice between having a Coke or a Pepsi in the absence of any kind of coercion is pretty much a free choice. You know, if they've got both there, I just decide I'm feeling like a Pepsi day. But when you start looking at more complicated choices, you know, the choice about, you know, let's say someone is an addict and they have been struggling with their use and maybe they have some time away from using, but then they're confronted with certain situations where they've got a choice whether or not to drink. That choice has so much backstory to it that it isn't that kind of easy, simple choice between Coke and Pepsi when I'm at the checkout line of the grocery store. But we act as if those choices are of the same degree of difficulty, and then we try to import the same expectations for responsibility on my Coke versus Pepsi choice versus my, oh my gosh, do I use again? Do I have one more drink? Do I think I can do it? And I want to say that's like comparing apples and car tires. It's not a good comparison.
Okay.
Where I'd like to bring in more rich moral language has to do with, this goes back to Aristotle, of trying to understand what kind of person do I want to be by looking at my character. What moral virtues do I want to be defining of me? Do I want to be known for? Would I want my friends to look at me and say, you know, Peg, she is generous, she is loyal, she is industrious, she is compassion is a funny one, that's sort of not necessarily a Greek virtue, but I mean, is she trustworthy? And to ask many people who struggle with addiction, and this is an interesting intersection with AA, when AA asks you to make a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves, a lot of people think, that's just listing all of my defects. And addicts, I think, become quite good at listing their defects. What they have a harder time doing is listing any positive attributes, any positive character traits, because they think they mustn't have any because they are an addict. I would love to bring back richer moral language about virtues so that people can begin in some ways to maybe chart out a course about who they want to be and the kinds of traits that they want to cultivate and embody, and look to other people who have those traits and take them as role models. And so at the end of the day, for me as someone who's trained in moral philosophy, the category of moral concerns is much broader than just responsibility in the sense of blame. It's character, it's moral virtues, it's duties, it's commitments, it's a matter of looking forward. Responsibility doesn't just look backwards to blame, but responsibility looks forward. It looks forward to who I want to be and how I want to be in the world and how I want to contribute to the world, to go back to that notion of individual flourishing is necessarily connected to social flourishing. And this is all the language of moral philosophy that you're not likely to see in most discussions of addiction and recovery and responsibility and choice.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that shift to, you know, future, you know, looking to the future, looking to the, and looking at the positive virtues, you know, I mean, that's about as much of a shift as, you know, as the idea is, you know, I made a mistake and I'm a failure. That same kind of, mm-hmm. you know, shift in perspective.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. And so how do we interrupt for those people who do tend to move right towards that I'm a failure? We got to give them some more tools and concepts to interrupt that quick movement, because that movement becomes habitual.
Yeah,
some
exactly.
Some people will always just go right there.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's reinforced by, you know, environment and society too. I mean, it's, you know, that going right to that spot, you know, if you're surrounded by a social network that puts you there, you know, that is constantly reminding you of mistakes and that kind of thing, that it makes it hard to make that shift. You know, it seems to me that one would have to really kind of shake up their circle, you know, mm-hmm. in a way to be able to break free of that constant pounding, you know, as to mistakes that were made.
I think that's absolutely right. So that's why when you see a lot of people when they are trying to get sober, I don't like the language of getting clean, but who are trying to make significant choices in their life, oftentimes feel as if they've got to leave a lot of friends behind, friends that they had when they were using. It gets more mm-hmm. tricky, though, when it's family, because you can't just always leave your family behind. That part A. Part B. Sorry. And part B internalize those judgments. So even in the absence of those actual particular others who'd be making that judgment about me, I'm able to make that judgment of myself because I've internalized all of those judgments. And how do I get away from myself? So you can maybe get away from friends. Harder to get away from mm-hmm. a lot of family. But then when you yourself embody all those judgments, there's no escape for yourself. And I think people get caught in that feedback loop, which then kind of justifies or explains maybe why they keep using.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, I kind of want to go back a little bit. When you were talking about the ancients and the basically that kind of like the beginning of self-help, you know, we're kind of self-help started. Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, there's one spot that you talk about the ancients understood that the care of the soul as the most important undertaking in human life and you know, talked about self. And in that, one of the the topics that you brought up is like, who is the self? And then the possibility of the drinking self versus sober self, you know? And so I would love for you, if you wouldn't mind spending a couple of minutes about talking about self and then your perspective about that sober drinking, you know, difference, if there is a difference.
Mm-hmm. So the question about self, am I the same self now on April 20th as I was in 2016, April 20th, 2015, April 20th, 10 years ago, 15, 50 years ago? That question about what makes a self continuous, how do you be the same person throughout time, is a deeply philosophical question, and it's a really charged question. And various philosophers have offered different answers to it. And I had a friend who asked me that question when I was teaching a course in what we call modern philosophy, so 1600 to about 1800. And I was reading John Locke at the time, an English philosopher. Everyone knows who John Locke is, even if they don't know who he is. He's the one who gave us life, liberty, and fill in the blank on the third. For Locke, it was property, but Thomas Jefferson borrowed it and said pursuit of happiness. So everyone, if they've had to study the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, would know Locke. So Locke's answering this question. Locke is a physician as well. And Locke says memories are the ties that bind us. In more contemporary language, memories are like a psychic shrink wrap. They're what hold us all together, so we aren't just this bundle of experiences or bundle of ideas or impressions. So memories are a crucial part of our identities, and there's something right in that. And Locke goes further to say, the person who has no memories has no identity. So in my class, I said to my students, who are always willing and happy to play along with me when these things come to me, I said, what about regular blackout drinkers? So blackout drinkers are still active and busy and doing in the world, but they have no memory of it. You know, they are in a blackout. It's as if they're functioning on a kind of autopilot where their conscious remembering mind isn't in the driver's seat. So I said to my students, you know, who is? Well, it's me, but it's not me, because that's not who I am when I'm not drunk. I mean, I have a drunk self and a sober self? And so there was this friend of mine asking me that same kind of question. Am I the same person? And am I the same self? And so much rides on that. So, for example, you know, how does someone who is now sober look back on all the things that they did when they were using? And it raises really important questions about, well, what does it mean to forgive yourself? What does self-forgiveness look like? And relatedly, what does self-knowledge look like? I mean, how is it that I know myself? And sometimes we all recognize that our friends, for example, can see things in us or about us that we can't see in ourselves, and that just may be a matter of perspective. You know, it's like, well, I know right now I can't read anything close up when I'm wearing my contact lenses because my eyes just don't adjust anymore. But someone else can say to me, hey, Peg, that's what that says. So when I'm looking at myself in that kind of way, it's a similar kind of, I can't see too closely because of my vision. Same thing in understanding oneself. And if philosophy really is about the care of your soul or the care of your person, self-knowledge is absolutely vital. It is critical. And so what does that look like? And boom, there you are in the middle of a big set of philosophical debates. But addicts live that question every day because they have to be able, in some ways, and people getting into recovery, need to be able to say, you know, I am this person. I have done these things. Self-knowledge and responsibility oftentimes go hand in hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and the, you know, this is one of those things that can, like you say, can take so many different twists and turns, you know, as far as perspective and what it means, you know, what it means to be, you know, to, you know, self versus, and also recognizing, you know, the distinction between actions taken, you know, things that have been done versus the actual essence of the individual, you know, and, you know, does, you know, past actions of being an addict and then no longer, you know, are making different choices where one is not using, does that, is that the whole essence of the individual? In other words, I mean, I'm, you know, you're here talking to me about this book that you wrote because of the experiences that you had and the changes that you made. So, I mean, you know, so in a sense, you know, you're, the past experience as well as the current experience is really the totality of self.
I think that's right. And a lot of philosophers and some psychologists talk about a narrative conception of self, that self is something that we in many ways actively construct as we interpret our experience and we slot them into a story that we tell about ourselves, who we are, how we are in the world, what we've done, maybe what we hope to do. And if the narrative conception of self is somewhat right, and I think it is somewhat right, what happens when there are those huge gaps? How do they get filled in? And I think people who are still struggling with addiction are going to fill them in with the least charitable and most self-condemning things that they can think of. Why? Because they believe they know the type of person that they really are. Even if others can't see that in them, deep down, I really know that I'm a moral failure or I'm a terrible person. I mean, all those sorts of things. And that's not a good model for self-knowledge.
No, no, it's not. My goodness. Well, gosh, we're halfway through the show already, Peg. So I want to go ahead and it was great. I want to take a quick, short 90-second break here, and I do want to invite listeners that if you would like to call in and ask Peg any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions for Peg, feel free to type them into the chat room, and we will get to those right after the break. And then right after the break, Peg, when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about, the government. The government says that drugs are bad, and does that make them bad? And then, mm-hmm. you know, how does this prescription culture that we have, mm-hmm. which, you know, how does that really play? Because that seems to be, mm-hmm. kind of an acceptance kind of drugs. So I'd like to talk about that when we come back, okay?
All good.
Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Dr. Peg O'Connor, and we're talking about her book, Life on the Rocks, Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery. And if your life is, if you are, or if your life is touched by someone with an addiction, then definitely go to Amazon.com and pick up a copy of her book. And I do have a direct link to her book there in the show page description. So with that, we're back, Peg.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be back.
Great. Great. Okay, so I want to kind of now talk about the idea of, you know, of not only the government saying, you know, drugs, which drugs are good or bad. Like right now we're in an environment where, you know, marijuana is being decriminalized in many ways by states, mm-hmm. but not by the federal government. I mean, then, well, let's deal with that one first. What's your opinion on that?
Let's just take on that little tiny topic, shall we? Oh, boy.
Let's start with it. Yeah.
Boy, do we have a really loaded, messed up situation with marijuana? Do I think marijuana is addictive? I certainly do. Do I think that marijuana can be especially dangerous for adolescents and young adults on their brains? Yeah, I do. Do I think that marijuana is a drug that saps motivation and that has a huge effect for students, high school and college students? I do. Do I also think the war on drugs perhaps got it so wrong about marijuana that we have landed in a complete mess when it comes to drug crimes and drug sentencing and the incredible number of people that we have incarcerated for drug offenses? I do. Now, having granted all of that, what do I think we should do? I honest to gosh don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, it just seems there are so many strands that you start to pull on. So, for example, when I think about medical marijuana, the fact that the U.S. government so tightly controlled marijuana that there haven't been good studies done on the possible beneficial effects for the use mm-hmm. of marijuana, you know, THC, the sort of active ingredient, as if I were writing an advertisement, and marijuana. We don't have a lot of good studies. What we have is a lot of anecdotal evidence and people testifying about the kind of relief it's given them or a loved one, and that's really, really powerful. I do think it's interesting where politicians are willing to take anecdotal evidence and where they're not. And I'll just sort of throw that out there. I'm not saying it's a Democratic thing. I'm not saying it's a Republican thing. I do think that when it comes to drugs, what counts as a relevant point gets really confusing. And about legalizing recreational marijuana, would that have some kind of beneficial effects with respect to regulating? It may. Would it probably help some states with more revenue generated from sales tax? It may. But on the other hand, it invites a host of problems we don't know how to deal with. So, for example, how do you test whether someone is impaired by marijuana in their operating a motor vehicle while under its influence? We don't know. So, you know, I'm interested in watching to see what's happening in Colorado, what kind of surprises they're having and what shouldn't be a surprise, but yet sometimes it's treated like a surprise. Like, surprise, more children are getting into the marijuana candy and eating a ton of it and overdosing and becoming really, really ill. Or more tourists go to Colorado and not knowing what they're buying and consuming end up in emergency rooms. That's a problem. Yeah. So we don't have any longitudinal data to try to even look at. It seems like we're really going about this in an ad hoc manner. And that's, I think, going to invite some kind of trouble. But I don't know how to go about it in a more systematic way that would be any more informed.
Yeah, it certainly is a conundrum, in a way, you know, as far as
and
when you look at legalization, I mean, again, with alcohol and its regulation, you know, that being, you know, legal, you know, with restrictions and that kind of thing, but still, you know, with some of that, you can obviously measure impairment and that kind of thing, but you know, just the whole idea of, you know, substance and legality, you know, it can be, can be quite a challenge. Now, you know, in a culture that we have where virtually every second or third commercial on television is some kind of drug, you know, mm-hmm. that is, you know, out there to help an ailment, and, you know, and then, you know, even, you know, from what I've heard or can read in, you know, kind of, you know, today's environment, you know, the oxy types of addictions kind of thing. How do addicts work with the idea that, you know, some of these drugs are being promoted as, you know, as legal, viable, you know, okay alternatives to, you know, the experiences of pain or, you know, you know what I mean? How do we, you know, work with addiction and, you know, what appears to be a drug culture?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's no more dangerous line in advertising than talk to your doctor or pharmacist. Because now mm-hmm. the way the pharmaceutical industry and lobbies have been working is that they are marketing directly to people, regular people. Before, advertisements used to be geared towards physicians and other healthcare providers. But now it's geared right to the consumer so that a person can go in and say, hey, I've got these five symptoms, and I think something like blah, blah would help me mm-hmm. address it. Now, the best doctors in the world, if they're pressed for time, probably aren't going to be able to do as thorough an exam and talk about alternative approaches or alternative methods. And in a culture, as you say, where you know, we are maybe looking for the quick fix in the form of a pill for whatever ails us, I think that individual consumers are putting a lot of pressure on physicians to just write the darn prescription and to, you know, be able to fill it quickly. And physicians are seeing patients on a conveyor belt if they're working for certain big healthcare, well, the healthcare industry, I think it is the way to talk about it. And so what you see happening, you see these absurd, crazy numbers. So, for example, I think it was in 2012, physicians wrote 250 million prescriptions for opioids. So that's only for opioids, 259 million prescriptions. Now, why?
That's insane. That's insane. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And we know that there is a direct link between prescription drug abuse of opioids and heroin. 4 out of 5 mm-hmm. new users of heroin had started out using prescription pain medications, and that many people, about 90%, who end up in treatment for opioid addiction had switched from opioids to heroin. So we see a very clear connection between the medical community, medical practitioners, and what's being regarded as a prescription drug epidemic that's also fueling a heroin epidemic. Now, what can we do differently? I know the U.S. government has come out with some guidelines for physicians in prescribing these, but there's got to be so much more that is done. Physicians need to educate themselves or educate one another. Something needs to give, because the other thing we're not hearing as much about the number of people who are getting hooked on sedatives, you know, your benzos. So you're right. We are becoming a largely drug-addicted society, and I'm going to go back to philosophy about healthy communities and healthy individuals are necessarily connected. And so unhealthy individuals are directly connected to unhealthy communities, and I think that's what we're seeing.
Yeah. Yeah, to me it's you know, when I see that, you know, to me it's just drives me crazy. You know, because it's just, you know, I remember the days when you wouldn't see, you know, advertisements for drugs on TV. I mean you just didn't. I mean, like you say, they went through the, you know, through the doctor, through that kind of that chain versus going direct to the individual. And And what also drives me crazy is that, you know, when you hear the side effect, well, you know, you may have an itching condition, but take this, and even though, by the way, there might be a side effect of death, you know, go ahead and you know.
Yeah, but it won't be itchy and it's just,
you won't be itchy anymore. Really. But,
that's
you know, and it's,
yeah.
It is, actually. Or even one of them recently, it's like, well, you know, if you have an adverse reaction to the ingredients, you know, stop taking it. Well, you know, that makes sense. But it's, you know, to me, it seems like it's putting a face on that taking drugs is okay. You know, that taking And not only just okay, but it's like preferred, or I mean, it's like a first course of action versus, you know, maybe a last resort, an action of last resort.
Well, and particularly when it comes to chronic pain and pain management, I think it's been pretty well established that these really powerful opioid drugs are not the most effective way to do that. But yet, mm-hmm. it continues to be the way that these conditions are being treated. The other really interesting thing when we take a look at prescription opioid abuse, so the New York Times ran an article, I'll say recently, so that means at least several months ago, that analyzed the data from 60 million death certificates and saw the ways in which the overdose rates for whites is becoming much higher than the overdose rates for blacks. And the question is why? And the answer is that it is structural racism that is keeping blacks from accessing the medical system. And even where they do have access to the medical system to see physicians, there's what's called the racial empathy gap, where whites in general believe that blacks don't feel pain in the same way or to the same degree, and that racial empathy gap translates right over into the medical community. So if you are a black patient with severe pain, even from something overtly obvious like, say that's a nasty compound fracture you have in your ankle, or pain from cancer, you are still far less likely to get prescribed opioid pain medications. So here's the ultimate perversity in how racism is working. By being shut out of access to the healthcare system, and even when gaining access to the healthcare system, because of racial discrimination, blacks aren't being given opioid pain prescriptions, which in some very perverse way is keeping them from developing that opioid pain addiction and moving on to heroin.
Yeah, that is a twist in the,
isn't that
in the
a
scheme
twist?
Of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is. And I didn't know about that racial empathy gap. I'm going to have to look more into that.
Look that up. It is terrible. Absolutely
very,
terrible.
Very
and of course, the perverse twist, though, is that black people also tend to underestimate or undervalue their own pain and the pain of other blacks. So that shows you about how you internalize oppressive, in this case, racist beliefs.
Interesting. Well, you know, I could see where, you know, in a culture where, you know, you're constantly under duress, you know, where, you know, that may become, you know, part of life, you know, in a way. So, you know, that pain and all that kind of thing would be no big deal. I mean, I've done worse, you know. I mean, I've experienced worse, you know. Yeah.
Right. Or the bone isn't sticking out yet, so I'll just say it's okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My goodness. Well, now we're getting down toward the end of the show, but there's one other thing I kind of want to address again. I mean, address that, you know, earlier in the show we talked about suffering, you know, and addiction and suffering, and about it being both a cause and a consequence of suffering. So it seems to me like a cycle or a catch-22 type of situation. Mm-hmm. So how does one break free, I guess, of that particular cycle?
Yeah, that's a really important question. How does one break free? Sometimes one breaks free, and this is a value, I think, of self-help groups, and I think this helps to explain why memoirs, so first-person stories, are so important for people perhaps who are newly in recovery. If you can listen to someone else's story about their, let's say, drug use and why people started using drugs and what happened to them, and oftentimes when you hear something similar to your own story, but it's in someone else's story and it's someone else saying that, that you can have some compassion for that person. Even when you can't have compassion for yourself, you can have compassion for that other person, because it loops back to the, well, I know that underneath it all, I'm really just this god-awful person, but I'm sure he wasn't as bad as I was. So you still have that distancing tendency. But when you can start to see yourself in the eyes or in the stories of others, if you hear yourself in their own words, I think oftentimes that does plant a seed. And that when you can start to break out of that, I think I talked about in the book as numb. Nobody understands how hard it is to be me, sort of that I'm numb, or the terminal uniqueness. It is a huge relief to begin to see that other people have suffered in some of the same ways as you have, or have perhaps suffered a lot worse. And when you can see that other people have suffered, and yet they go on, yet they are able to make sense, they're able to suit up and show up in their lives, that I think that sometimes holds out some hope for you. And maybe you can't believe that you can do it, but you see this other person doing it. And there's a wonderful expression, the founder of Salvation Army, this is really objectionable language, but the founder of the Salvation Army was talking about wanting to help save the outcasts. So by that he meant pretty much the drunks. Mm-hmm. One of the things he says there that's really useful is that it really matters to someone when another person of good human decency takes an interest in whether they are to rise or to sink. And I think a lot of times when people are addicted, they can't have any goodwill towards themselves, and so they have to borrow it from other people until they can begin to generate it for themselves. And I think that's what a lot of support groups do for people. I think that's what was a lot happening, say, in the 1970s, feminism and consciousness raising, that people were borrowing the goodwill or a sense of decency, a sense of worth from other people. And that helps to plant a seed so you can begin to generate that on your own. If you can't begin to generate that on your own, then that's a serious problem. And I think that's some reason why you talk to some people maybe who have tried quitting, but they keep relapsing, try quitting, and they keep relapsing. Oftentimes what you hear maybe from the tiniest little corner of their being is that they really aren't worth it.
Yeah.
That they don't deserve it. And that's debilitating, and that's tragic. But if you don't think that you're worth saving, if you don't think your life is worth living, then why bother?
Yeah, I agree. I could see that. Well, gosh, we're down to the last few minutes. So is there any final words, any kind of information that you may want to give the listeners that we haven't covered that you really want to convey before we close out the show?
This has been such a great conversation, and I do hope that anyone who struggles with their own addiction or has a loved one who struggles with it might find something useful in this book. Philosophy can be really useful, contrary to how it's displayed in the public all the time. That philosophy is really useful, and that it can help to understand and transform suffering. And I am always happy to talk with anyone about it. I have people email me. I love hearing from people about this kind of work that I do and hearing their stories for those very reasons I just said. I have heard more echoes of my story in Complete Strangers than I can even begin to describe, and that is a blessing.
That is great. Yeah, that's, you know, that's one of those things where it has to be rewarding. And you know, and whenever you put, you know, I'm always in admiration of someone who will go forward and put out their story, you know, for others to examine and for them to, you know, to kind of, you know, to be out there, to be, you know, in front of people. And it's kind of like, this is who I am, this is what I did, let me help you, you know, let me see if I can help you. You know, to me, that's wonderful. So many people try to hide behind, you know, keep these things in the shadows. And
well,
when, in fact,
shame.
You know, when you,
yep.
Yeah, it is, yeah. So anyway, you have my admiration for doing that. And
well,
I really
want
to thank you.
Well, thank you, Robert. I mean, for all the work you do with your show. I mean, definitely bringing inspiration.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And now, are you on social media at all?
Not too much. The best place to read me is on my blog, Philosophy Stirred, Not Shaken, on psychologytoday.com. I post regularly to that, so you can see what I'm up to there.
Great. Well, I'll be checking it out there as well. So thank you again for your time today, Peg. I really enjoyed our conversation.
I enjoyed it too. Thanks so much, Robert.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dr. Peg O'Connor, author of Life on the Rocks, Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery. And again, her book is available at Amazon.com. And I do have a direct link in the show page description to her book there. So definitely get yourself a copy and get one for someone you care about. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.